This interview with Professor Kevin McKeegan of UCLA about results from the Genesis mission is part of the Jodcast. For the full show and the archives, go to www.jodcast.net.
Mm-hmm. So you are a cosmochemist.
I'm all my degrees are in physics. I mean, so I'm trained as a physicist, but and to the extent that I build instrumentation and fly them in space, I'm still doing physics. But most, you know, the label that fits best my research is cosmochemist. So
what does that mean?
It means basically we study the origin of the elements and of planetary materials.
Mm. So you're specifically looking at the elements in our own solar system.
That's right. I mean, it's basically a question of origins. Mm. And so everything from actually how the elements came to be and how they got into our solar system to the kind of chemistry that's involved, chemistry and physics that's involved in making planets. And, you know, and also even the time scales. So the whole issue of chronology is also something that's in our bailiwick.
Yeah. So you have a particular element of interest.
Yes. The most interesting element in the solar system, I just described it as oxygen. Oxygen is the major element on the Earth and in all rocky planets. And it's the third most abundant element in the solar system. Just following from hydrogen and helium.
Hmm. We often think about, because astronomers, we kind of stop after helium because things we just then call, let's call them metals, and right. We don't worry about them.
Right. So this is one, you know, there's a large area of overlapping interest between astronomers and astrophysicists and cosmochemists having to do with this issue of star and planet formation. But one of the areas that we're, you know, you can tell that some of our interests diverge is just because, in fact, the astronomers simplify the periodic table to hydrogen, helium, and everything else. And we are pretty much interested only in the everything else. Mm-hmm. So we're not really concerned that much with the hydrogen and helium. Hydrogen to the extent that it affects the chemistry in what we call the solar nebula, which astronomers would call the accretion disk of the sun. Helium, not so much really, because it doesn't make rocks.
And presumably that's where oxygen comes in.
That's where oxygen comes in, indeed. Oxygen is such an interesting element because by virtue of its abundance and its chemistry, it is the dominant element in rocks, but it's also a very important element in the gas phase. So in the gas phase in our solar nebula, it exists as both carbon monoxide, CO, and also H2O. Mm-hmm. As well as in some minor compounds, but those would be the major compounds and then in the dust. And so the fact that oxygen can partition between these different phases gives it some interesting properties and gives it a kind of diagnostic capabilities that we'd like to understand.
What are these interesting properties that oxygen has?
Okay, well, actually, in order to really discuss the properties of oxygen, we also need to not only talk about its chemistry, but its isotopes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so oxygen has three stable isotopes, oxygen 16, 17, and oxygen 18. So all of oxygen has eight protons. That's what makes it oxygen. All right, so but the 17 and 18 have one extra neutron compared to oxygen 16. So oxygen 16, 8 protons and 8 neutrons, and oxygen 17, 8 protons and 9 neutrons, and oxygen 18 then would have 10 neutrons. Now that in itself is important because the oxygen isotopes themselves are made in different kinds of nucleosynthetic processes in different kinds of stars. So the overwhelming majority of oxygen, the stuff that we're breathing now, is oxygen 16. All right. So it's, if you have 10,000 atoms of oxygen, then only 20 of those atoms will be oxygen 18, and only 4 roughly will be oxygen 17. And the rest, 9,900 and whatever, 76, I guess, if I did my math right, are oxygen 16. And the reason is that oxygen 16 is just made more prevalently in stars. It's on the direct alpha nucleosynthesis chain, whereas oxygen 17 and 18 require seed nuclei, and they're made in different stellar environments. Hmm. So right away, we have these differences in isotopes, and this occurs for almost all the elements, these kind of differences. And what happens is that as the material is ejected from stars and goes through the interstellar medium and eventually winds up in some kind of a dense region of a molecular cloud that's going to collapse and form an accretion disk and form a star, that all these different sources get mixed up. And we get, for most of the elements in the periodic table, this mixing process is extremely thorough, such that we can define a, quote, normal composition, which by normal we mean the composition that's here. This is always the way we define normal, right? Yeah. The Earth is at the center of everything until we find out that it's not. All right, and so that's very much what we're after in terms of this project, this Genesis project, is a question of understanding origins. And it turns out that we've known now for 35 years, since the pioneering work done at University of Chicago by Bob Clayton and his colleagues, that the oxygen that went into the solar system is not isotopically well homogenized.
What does that mean?
That means that different meteorites and every different sample of a planetary rocky object that we have our hands on, when you analyze it in detail in the laboratory in a mass spectrometer, have some differences in their relative abundances of oxygen 16, 17, and 18 that cannot be ascribed to kind of normal chemical differences that we know about from the rocks in the garden out here, or the oceans, or what have you. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's some difference in the way these oxygen isotopes distribute themselves that either reflects some inheritance. This was the original idea, that it reflects an inheritance from the pre-solar cloud, from wherever our material came from whatever ensemble of stars contributed oxygen to eventually make the Earth and the planets and the sun, or that there's some processes that go on during this epoch of planet formation that cause differences. So, for example, we have some meteorites that we think come from Mars. We have other, meteorites that we know come from various asteroids. And if we grind up these rocks and analyze them in the mass spectrometer, we'll find out that the relative amounts of oxygen 16 they have compared to the 17 and 18 are distinct. Mm. Okay, so if I would give you a rock and you could take it to a mass spectrometer and you could tell me whether this was an Earth rock or not.
Yeah.
Just on the basis of the oxygen isotopes. So it's kind of a fingerprint. And Clayton made his discovery on certain phases in primitive meteorites where these effects are quite large. Quite large in this context means several percent. All right, so we're really dealing with high precision measurements that have to be made.
This is a problem, though, surely, because when you take a look at meteorites, we've always assumed that meteorites are the debris from the formation of the solar system, presumably the Earth formed from the same material. Why should the fraction of oxygen isotopes be different in meteorites compared to what we find on Earth?
That's an excellent question. And truth is, no one knows the answer.
But we know that there is a difference.
We know that there is a difference. And in fact, this is there are a small group of people who like to think about how to make an Earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just an Earth, but the Earth. And they can take various things that we know or we think we know about the Earth, such as, the ratio of one kind of chemical element to another, magnesium to silicon or aluminum to silicon ratios, and then try to make this compatible with what we know about the isotopic structure of those elements that are in the Earth. And when people do this exercise, they cannot agree. So we do not know how to make the Earth, in fact, out of the existing meteorite population. There are very few meteorites which are absolutely compatible with the oxygen isotopes of the Earth. And those have other differences that it's hard to imagine that the Earth comes directly from them. So the Earth is a mixture of different materials. Presumably, most of that material formed somewhere around one astronomical unit, or at least at some time was found in that region, and that the Earth at some point reached enough gravity that it started to agglomerate all these materials to itself. And that composition then on the Earth has become homogenized because of the great internal heat engine of the Earth. So mm-hmm. all the oxygen on the Earth is homogenized by virtue of this geologic activity on the Earth that's been going on for billions of years.
So that means the homogenization of oxygen isotopes on the Earth means that the mm-hmm. oxygen, whatever we find in seawater, for instance, is the same, or the ratio of isotopes of oxygen we find in seawater is the same as we find in rocks, is the same we find in trees.
It's not exactly the same, but the differences are well understood, and it's compatible with having equilibrated with each other mm-hmm. in some way. So there is a subtle partitioning of the oxygen isotopes that goes on between, say, waters and rocks. And this, in fact, is one of the ways we know about the paleoclimate on the Earth, because this partitioning of the oxygen isotopes between minerals that will precipitate out of water, and the water is temperature dependent.
Right.
So things like corals could record this, or other forms of carbonate deposits will record this. And this is how we think we understand things about ocean temperatures into past geologic time. So that's completely, reasonably completely well understood.
But
I'm talking about something different in the sense that the differences between meteorites and between planets are differences such that those reservoirs of material, of oxygen, were never homogenized with each other, or they're not now. If they were, there was a way to split them up in a way that is not normal kind of chemistry.
So does this suggest that the original planetary nebula had pockets of different isotope ratios?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And these pockets are... Some of these differences are preserved in meteorites, and then on a larger scale, they're preserved actually in planets. The fact that the Earth and the Moon, for example, have identical oxygen isotope ratios is the major argument that the origin of the Earth and the origin of the Moon are intimately related, and that the Earth did not, for example, capture the Moon randomly afterward, after it formed somewhere else and came by.
It would be extremely unlikely that the Moon
would be very, very unlikely. Yeah.
Have exactly the same isotope ratios.
Right. Mm. Exactly.
So I guess people would have considered this in their formation models of the protoplanetary nebula in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go away to their computers and work out whether it is possible to maintain separate pockets of distinct isotope mm-hmm. ratio regions in the nebula. Is that possible, do you think?
Well, what people have been trying to understand is what are the mechanisms which could give rise to these distinct populations of oxygen isotope, you know, objects in the solar system. And there are a number of ideas, hypotheses that have been put forth. And the problem is, in choosing between these various ideas, we don't really know where to start from. All right. So, it's as if, okay, at the moment, the situation is we kind of have a map of the solar system, the inner solar system, in terms of these oxygen isotope parameters. The problem is we don't know how to read this map because we don't know anything about what the starting composition is. This is very unusual. In most cases, we make an approximation. Things are so homogenized that we can at least come up with an approximate uniform composition. And from that, we try to understand small deviations from that. In the case of oxygen, it's just not possible because every meteorite meteorite gives us a different answer. And there's no reason a priori to choose one over the other. So people want to develop an understanding of the processes that could cause this, whether it's input from another star, whether it's some kind of chemical process that occurs during the solar nebula phase before the accretion of planetesimals and things like the Earth, or whether it's something else. And the answer, to some extent, has to be sought by expanding our database, and the best way to do that is to actually sample the sun. Because as it stands right now, we reference things that we know about the sun are really defined from primitive meteorites in high precision. This is a kind of, I don't want to say house of cards, but it's philosophically on shaking grounds because,
it's a bit awkward, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the solar abundances for the refractory elements, okay, so not for things like hydrogen and helium and you know, abundant volatile elements in the sun, but for everything else, for the, you know, the iron, the copper, the zinc, the barium, whatever element you care to name that astronomers would just call a metal, but chemists care about, these are defined by the analyses of meteorites. And in particular, you know, there's a class of meteorites which is thought to be more chemically primitive, unaltered than others. And so it's very strange that, you know, some rock falls out of the sky in 19th century France. We measure this and now we put it, it's in a drawer in a museum and we say, that's what the sun is. Okay. Well, that's a strange concept. And the problem is we can do this for the refractory objects, but for, of refractory elements, but for things that really exist also in a gas phase that don't go into rocks, we know that that answer must be wrong. Mm-hmm. And one of them is oxygen, the most important one. So, you know, whereas for barium, for example, we pretty much have a good model of what the barium in the sun must be and what the average barium in the solar system must be. For oxygen, we have no idea. And so the best way to do this is to go get a piece of the sun and measure directly the ratios of oxygen 16, 17, and 18 in solar material.
Bring us nicely to the Genesis mission. Tell us about the Genesis mission.
Okay, so that is the major goal, the highest science priority goal of the Genesis mission. There are other ones we can talk about later as well. But the idea of Genesis is to actually capture a bit of the sun and bring it back to terrestrial laboratories to do the kind of detailed analyses that have to be done to see these small differences, okay, percent level or less differences in these isotope abundances. And this is what the mission accomplished. I mean, it's conceptually fairly simple. It's very difficult to go to the sun and get a shovel full of it, okay, because it's 6,000 degrees on the surface. And, you know, the standard crack is, well, couldn't you go at night? You know, okay, well, no. And so what you do is you let the sun come to you, okay? The sun, of course, has a lot of gravity, but it's also very hot, and the interactions with the magnetic fields of the sun create a very high temperature atmosphere, the solar corona. And this has enough energy that it can actually be expelled from the sun as a kind of wind. All right. So this, the solar wind, you know, pervades the entire solar system, expands out from the sun in a complicated way. It's what gives rise to the aurora on Earth. So the northern lights and so on are the interaction of the solar wind with our atmosphere. And if you can put a spacecraft outside the magnetic field of the Earth, you can be hit by the solar wind. And so that's the idea of Genesis, is that you take very pure materials, you get them outside the magnetic sphere of the Earth, and then you expose them to the sun, and the solar wind is a wind of atomic ions. It's a plasma, so it's electrically charged, but it's particulate material. I mean, it's atomic nuclei that are ionized. And it has enough energy that if it strikes a solid material, it can implant itself very, very slightly below the surface. And so it'll go in and stick. Hmm. And so that's the idea. So that's what we did. The Johnson Space Center in Houston, they assembled in an ultra-clean environment these really high-purity materials that were then put on a spacecraft and flown out about a million miles toward the sun, toward the so-called Lagrange point L1. There you can basically stay there with very minimal expenditure of energy and go around with the Earth for 2 years while staring at the sun, collecting the solar wind. Mm-hmm. And then after the collection time, the collectors are stored back into a sample return capsule. Think of a giant clamshell kind of arrangement that closes up. And then the spacecraft just gently cruises back to Earth and drops off its payload, which comes back to the Earth, which we collect.
Yeah. Big advantage of doing the sample return missions is that you don't need to jam a spacecraft full of analysis equipment.
Absolutely. This is an enormous advantage, and it's a huge credit to Don Burnett, who's the principal investigator of the mission, who's a professor at Caltech, that he convinced NASA that not all of the mission hardware has to be launched from the surface of the Earth. So, for example, the instrument that is in my laboratory, which made some of these oxygen isotope measurements, weighs, I'm not sure, somewhere around 7 or 8 tons. Okay, so this was not something that you really want to spend to the money to launch it. And but sample return missions, in all seriousness, they have really huge advantages, both in terms of practical issues like mass and energy and so on, but also philosophically. Very important is that measurements can be repeated.
Yes.
Questions can be asked which were not pre-anticipated. So if I'm going to send a spacecraft to Jupiter, I have to know when I go by that, you know, when I get there, what am I going to do? And you may not get that many chances to change your mind. And that's not the way normal science works. Normal science works by scientists challenging each other.
Oh, by the way, we should try this.
You know? Yeah, they challenge each other, or you find something unexpected and you have to follow up on it and so on. And this is, you know, a huge advantage. I mean, the moon rocks are still being worked on 35 years later after somebody left the moon. And we're still learning a lot from that because of that dynamic. So
now, the Genesis return capsule landed in spectacular fashion in the Utah desert.
Yes. Inelegant, we like to say. Yes.
We spoke with Don Burnett about the details of that particular aspect of the mission. So we won't go into it here. But suffice to say that we learned from Don Burnett that pretty much all of the science goals of the Genesis mission will be accomplished.
That's
despite
right.
the fact that the capsule crash landed.
That's right.
You made the point that you have now quite a few more samples returned than or at least yes. smaller pieces.
I think Don put it well at one point after the crash. He said something to the effect of, "Well, if you're going to hit a planet, Earth is the best one."
Yes.
Because you can literally pick up the pieces. And first of all, you can also tell what went wrong. We know unequivocally what went wrong. Whereas if you crash into Mars, you're never maybe quite sure.
Yes.
We've got the samples back, and the crash was not such that you could not dislodge those solar wind ions out of the sample by crashing them at terminal velocity into the desert floor in Utah. Or as I like to say, dropping them from the top of the atmosphere. but you know, there was some problems with additional difficulties with contamination and also sample size, you know, not being as readily available and so on. It slowed progress. But again, the strength of a sample return mission is that eventually it doesn't matter how long it takes.
Yes,
you still can get there.
Yes,
you still can get there. Right.
Now let's talk about how you actually get the little bits of solar wind out of your ultra pure collector material.
Okay. So we worked on something from a dedicated part of the spacecraft called the concentrator, which really was dedicated toward enhancing the concentration of oxygen. So it would focus preferentially oxygen into a smaller target. And the target that was chosen for this application is a single crystal of silicon carbide, which is very pure in the sense there's an unmeasurably low amount of oxygen that's in it. Mm. But there's still oxygen contamination on the surface. And the solar wind is implanted in a, you know, the solar wind ions come in with different angles and different energies, so they don't all go to the same depth. There's a distribution of depths. And the peak of that distribution is something like, in our case, 70 or 80 nanometers below the surface.
So you've got to figure out a way of discriminating between the oxygen at 70 nanometers below the surface contaminant of oxygen on the surface of your collecting material.
That's right. That's right. So we have contamination on the surface, we have background in our instrument, and then we have this sample of the sun, but it's only 70 nanometers or so below the surface. And the way that we do this is we exploit an instrument which was actually developed or found major application in the semiconductor industry, which is called a secondary ion mass spectrometer. Basically, what you do is you have your sample surface and you shoot a beam of ions at the sample. The beam is focused down and you can raster it or move it across the sample surface. And the beam has enough energy that when it impacts the sample surface, it will break atomic bonds and it will liberate material from the surface of the sample. And it will physically erode it. So think about like sandblasting on an atomic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally erode this atomic layer by atomic layer. As we do this, there's some mixing that goes on, and we want to minimize that. But we have ways to try to minimize that so that we can then, you know, we hit the surface. Most of that is terrestrial oxygen, either from our laboratory or from the Utah desert or from, you know, being in the air in Texas, which is very humid. Anybody's been there, or so forth. And we get rid of that by just physically eroding it away. And then it's called sputtering. As we sputter into the sample, we'll see the oxygen concentration go down, and then we see it come back up. And then that peak of oxygen that we see is the solar oxygen that's been put into the sample, in space. And so our job then is to erode through this, implanted layer of oxygen and to quantitatively count. We count literally atom by atom that comes out of there, as long as they come at less than about 1 million per second, we can count them all.
Wow.
over a million per second, we start losing some track, but we know that.
roughly how many are you counting per second?
At the peak of that oxygen profile from the sun, we're up to about 100,000 oxygen 16s per second.
Right.
But that's only about 40 oxygen 17s. And
yes.
That's the problem. We have to do both.
Yes.
We have to be able to accurately count at 100,000 per second and at only a few per second.
How are you discriminating between the two isotopes?
Okay. So the ions are released from the sample. Well, when the atoms are released from the sample by the sputtering process, some of them get ionized in that process. When they get ionized, they gain an extra electron, and so they become a negative ion of either oxygen 16, oxygen 17, or oxygen 18. And once they have an electric charge, then we know we can manipulate them almost at will. So we can put them in a strong electric field, and we can collimate this beam of ions, and then if we make it pass through a magnetic field, they'll get spread out according to their charge to mass ratio. In the experiments that we've done for Genesis, we do one other little trick, and that is that we take this beam of negative oxygen ions and we inject it into an accelerator, which takes their energy from not very much all the way up to well over a million volts. And when they're at that high energy of a million volts, we remove electrons from them by having them have interactions with a gas of argon. And the reason we do this is because in addition to the oxygen isotopes that we collect, this process of sputtering, although it's really, really good for having good sensitivity and also for being able to discriminate against the surface oxygen, it doesn't just make atomic ions of oxygen. Okay, whatever's in the sample will come out in an ion. And one of the things that's in the sample is hydrogen, because the sun is mostly hydrogen. So we can't avoid that. There's a hydrogen implanted in the sample. And the problem is hydrogen will attach itself to oxygen. All right. If two hydrogens attach, it becomes water. It's H2O. I'm not so worried about that. That doesn't happen that often in the sputtering process. But one of the things that does happen is that one hydrogen will attach itself, and it will make an OH minus ion.
Mm-hmm. And a hydroxyl ion.
A hydroxyl ion. Mm-hmm. So the OH, the problem is oxygen 16 is so much more abundant than oxygen 17. If I attach a hydrogen to an oxygen 16, it will look to a mass spectrometer like oxygen 17. So I have to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. So the way we do that is when we take this beam up to a million volts and we have it encounter argon, electrons are stripped off in this process, and molecular bonds don't like to have two or three electrons removed. That's what's holding the molecule together, so the molecule blows itself apart. So coming out the other end of this accelerator, now I have a positively charged beam, but there's nothing in it except oxygen 16, 17, and 18. So if I can collimate this beam, and again, I pass it through a very big magnet in this case, I separate those beams out physically, so they're something like 10 centimeters apart. And then I put detectors there that can individually count the arriving ions. Everything's under computer control, of course, and all we then have to do is just get the relative abundances of these things. And that is the number that we're after. So it's a lot of work to get actually two numbers.
So the big question is, what is the isotope ratio of the sun?
So we have some initial data that are extremely exciting and surprising to many people, because it looks like there's a large difference between the Earth and planetary materials and what we find for the sun, in the sense that the sun is more enriched in oxygen 16 by somewhere around 6 or 7% compared to the Earth and compared to Mars and other meteorites, all of which have differences from each other, but those differences are rather small. The sun appears very, very different. Hmm. So now we're in a situation where we need to understand what happened to make a star and then make its planets, at least in the inner solar system where we have samples, so different in terms of the most abundant element that makes rocks. So it looks like the Earth is completely anomalous. It's weird. We used to define normal for oxygen based on ocean water. Well, there's nothing special about the ocean except that there's a lot of it on the surface of this planet, and we like it, of course. But other than that, from a cosmic perspective, it's not special. And now it looks that it's weird.
Yeah. We have much more ocean than we have solar wind, at least in ultra-pure materials that we can analyze.
That's true. Yeah, it's certainly a convenient reference. I'm not arguing that. It's just that now it looks like the sun is very different from that. And our challenge is to understand how that's come to be and what it tells us about planet formation.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a mystery.
It's still a bit of a mystery, yes. It's very early days. These data have not yet been published. we're working toward that. There's a few loose ends we need to tie up. And then it will be time for trying to understand what they're telling us. And there are several competing models out there. They need to all be evaluated in the context of the data and then look for confirmation or not. The models will be useful to the extent that they can make predictions about other things that we should see, and then that's how we'll bootstrap our way to learning more about this whole process.
Fantastic. Thank you very, very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We look forward to the results.
Okay.